Maybe the fishmonger who hands over the dead so tenderly. Or maybe the one rolling sushi wearing a hairnet and a half smile. Or maybe no one. For I have held hands with a stone. I have held hands with an orphan poplar tree whose leaves chattered like the milk teeth of a kid left for dead in a woven basket. I have held the freckled, sunburnished face of the lily and stroked her with my palm, my fingerprints overwhelmed by her rusty pollen. Maybe her. Maybe the aproned fishmonger who has held hands with a boning knife and brushed away crushed ice from the cloudy eye and rid the pinkish flesh of pin bones, or no one. For when I was a girl, I held my father's cold hand, and he wore something like an apron, a cotton gown fastened with bows at the back, a gown covered in blue stars. And his black eyelashes splayed out like the open arms of starfish. And oh, he was sad. There was salt in his cloudy eye, and something swam up into my throat and spawned and flapped its great tail. So perhaps I'm adrift in a skiff, spiraling the hub of that tender sea. Or maybe the fishmonger, maybe the mute cashier, or no one, or never, or the ancient bagger tattooed with an anchor.
You know, Di, people are always talking about Kalamazoo and how rich with the literary arts is. What is it? Is it in the water? There's a theory out there that it's you, that you're something of an icon, you and Conrad Hilberry. So tell us the story, because it interweaves with you and Con.
It does. I mean, there's no me without Con. When I was 15, I believe, I went to a rural high school in Niles, so not even the main town high school, but Brandywine out in a cow pasture. And Con was a poet in the schools then. And he was signed up to go to Niles High School, but he'd read a poem of mine that I was sort of naive enough to send to a contest for which he was the judge. And he gave it an honorable mention, but he didn't forget it. And so he came on his own volition to my high school. My first image of him is limping, because he had a limp, up the hallway to meet me. And he said, you know, I read that poem. Do you have any more of those? And I did. I went home and got my dad's briefcase, which is what I used for poems. And he just read through them all typed on a manual typewriter. And he said, let's give a reading together. So we read at the school.
And you're 15, 16.
Yes.
And you're reading with Con Hilberry.
Yes. Wow. And I was completely blown away. And up until that point in my life, I wasn't a serious student. I wrote poems, but very sort of intuitively. I didn't think of myself as pursuing this great art. But meeting him, then he began to send me books and talk to me about how I might go to college. And that's how I ended up in Kalamazoo. I suddenly, because of Con, started seeing myself as having a future.
He's the definition of a mentor.
He really is. And he does it with such grace. An amazing thing happened the other day. The first book he ever sent me was Diane Wachowski's Inside the Blood Factory. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't know women wrote poems. I mean, this was way back. Let alone one named Diane, and let alone a title, Inside the Blood Factory.
Yeah.
And which was right in my sweet spot. And the other day, she wrote me an email out of the blue, never met her, saying she read my poem in The New Yorker.
Oh, there's a full circle in there that's very satisfying.
Oh, my gosh. It was incredible.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing Con did. So I taught at his side as a TA and learned to teach by osmosis in a lot of ways. I mean, we're very different people, but
yeah,
I learned his kind of his kindness, his sort of everybody's invited to the party mentality. And lo and behold, just through a strange, again, kind of circular spiritual moment, I started teaching at Kay and ended up now kind of in the job that he was in.
So it kind of seems that Khan wasn't just a mentor to your poetry, but also to you being someone who teaches.
Yes, very much.
And you've been at Kalamazoo College since 1988?
Yep.
As writer in residence.
Yes. I was an adjunct for a long time, and then at a certain point, they had to sort of figure out what to do with me, and so they gave me a title, writer in residence.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit more about your role at Kay. You don't only teach, you're something of a bridge to the community.
I hope so. I hope I am.
You bring in other authors?
I bring in, yes, as many writers as I can. The world of poetry, nobody makes any money, so, or very few people. So we do a lot of bartering, you know, well, I'll come to your school if you'll come to my school. So, and another thing that's happened recently, which is really cool, is that former students are now publishing books, and they're coming back because they want to read.
Nice.
Yeah, at their alma mater. So, yes, I think that's, I notice that the more students can hear people coming, you know, we read their book and then they come, the more changed they are, the more influenced they are by that experience.
But I also hear about your participation, not just with Kalamazoo College students, but adults who are exploring their poetic side, writers groups. Are you in a teacher role or you're a participant?
Well, for a long time, I taught a workshop for women writers. It went through a lot of sort of a long evolution. And then I started doing that at the Stryker Center, and then I did it on my own with a kind of core group of writers, from Bonnie Jo Campbell to Marion Boyer, Elaine Seaman, all the names, Susan Ramsey, Gail Martin.
See what I said about Kalamazoo?
I know, there's so many. And sort of less, you know, I feel like almost any of us could have been the teacher, and I kind of had the initiative to say, well, I'm going to do this class.
Yeah.
And then tried to, my goal was always to kind of shake them up, like get them out of habitual relationships with language, because it's so easy to get habitual, as you know. So I'm not able to do that anymore right now. I'm hoping to be able to pick it back up again when I don't have to teach so much. It seems like in Kalamazoo, creativity, writing, and other arts too, it's almost contagious. And the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So we all contribute what we are and have to that energy, and we also have it to draw upon.
Yeah.
I'm a funny combo because, like a lot of poets, maybe I'm also kind of a hermit, and I need that solitude in order to work. So I go out of my hole and then I go back in. And, you know, I have felt a calling, I guess, or a responsibility to mentor others as I was mentored from my younger K students who are all, you know, who are doing amazing things in the world, to writers who are more peers, just doing that thing we do for each other, look at each other's manuscripts and weigh in. And
I did an interview a while back with an author, Lori May, who talked about literary citizenship.
Yes, yes.
And that it is something that we need to do for our community, that as much as writers are paired with solitude, we need to help each other.
I really believe that. And I try to do that in a number of ways. From sending poems to so-called smaller magazines and not just, you know, wanting to be in the big leagues and helping small magazines get seen, to reading manuscripts for presses who want an out, you know, external view mm-hmm. of a manuscript. So, yes, in Kalamazoo and also in other places as well. And then, you know, I do a lot of looking at other writers' work all over the country, and I see that as something, it feeds my work in the end.
Sure, yeah.
Because to think about what's right and what's not going well in a book, also then when I'm working, I can go, oh yeah, and I do that too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's very helpful to me as well.
Now, we're here today to talk about Four-Legged Girl.
Mm.
You've got three collections now, or almost. We're right on the threshold here. Four-Legged Girl by Grey Wolf Press as publisher. So talk to us about the journey of first collection, second collection, third. Did you change? Did the poetry change? What's
Boy,
your journey?
That's a huge question. Well, I wrote from the time, as you know, I was a teenager, and I didn't send work out for a long time. And this is often how women are, I find. I urge my students, when they're ready, to send work out and get going on it. But it was a different climate when I was coming up as well in publishing, and I just didn't feel ready. And I probably was right. So I really, to be honest, didn't start sending work out until I was well into my 30s. And Herb Scott was here, and he kind of said, you know, put a manuscript together, let me see it, for early New Issues Press. And that was It Blows You Hollow. And I remember sitting with him and David Dodd Lee, and David would kind of go, yes, no, 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 yes, you know, just kind of shuffling through the collection. And
did you get bloodied, or did that feel good to you?
It kind of felt good. There's something about having a good editor, as you, I'm sure you know, that feels like, oh, thank God, you know, like it's not just me. And, but I didn't know what I was doing in many ways. I didn't get an MFA. I didn't go that sort of typical route. I have a master's in social work. And so it was all a new experience. I remember a very well-known writer who's no longer living in town, but he was then, saying to me, so are you going to be like Emily Dickinson and hide your work under the bed? And, you know, now if he asked me that question, in a way, I feel like intuitively I knew what I was doing. And I was waiting for the right time for me. You know, women, I mean, at the time I had at least two jobs and I was raising a young son. And it wasn't my priority. Then I think I was working my craft.
Mm-hmm.
Through teaching, I've learned so much about writing. And in that way, I'm very self-taught. So after It Blows You Hollow, which came within a month after it was published, my ex-husband left. Then our Wolf Lake White Gown Blown Open, I worked on a lot of rejection. And I changed one poem for a final try, moving Jesus Wept and So Did Rowena Lee to the front place, as it seemed like a good entry point, and maybe I was asking too much of people in the first poem, and it won the Juniper Prize, and then two other publishers wanted it. So, boy, that taught me a lot about how you set up a manuscript and how important that first poem can be. A lot of times it's grad students reading. And
that's true. Yeah.
So you don't want to sort of, you want to provide a clear entry point, I think.
Yeah.
Actually, I just wrote an essay about this for a book that's going to be on putting together manuscripts, which is a mysterious process. winning the Juniper Prize was a big deal. That's a very important prize. And it probably at that point, I started seeing myself more as like, oh, you know, maybe I'm good at this. Maybe it's not just sort of this thing I do.
You are.
And so after that, I started working on, you know, there are sort of two ways to work on a book of poems. One is just write and write what comes next and see, you know, and then after a while you have a bunch of poems and you see how it works together. Or sort of more intentionally work on a project. And I'd say my first three books, including this one, are more books in which I worked on poems as they emerged in me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you send it out, you get feedback, you get no. Gray Wolf said no at first, gave me some suggestions, none of which I took. I did other things.
Yeah.
I got rid of a lot. I put in new stuff. It used to be called Blowtorch the Hinges. And suddenly it felt like a cool thing to have an image as the title. Like Four-Legged Girl seemed very compelling rather than an action, Blowtorch. But, you know, just keep getting rid of the weaker, bring in the stronger.
It's a lot of little tweaks.
A lot of tweaks. And a lot of, especially working with Gray Wolf, it's a stupendous editor. And man, he sees everything, everything. And it's so wonderful to be that seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, to have him say, here's where you're doing a hyphen wrong or something. It's like, thank you. As well as larger things, you know, I keep hearing the end of the final poem differently than you have it. Could we try this? It just, you feel less alone. So this book went through more rejection. You know, I remember Laura Kosciuszko saying to me, who also won the Juniper Prize, don't think that's a ticket to anything because it isn't, which is true with poetry. It's like you're only as good as is the manuscript. So this book it was asked for by two presses at the same time. I don't know why that's my horrible fate.
Oh, horrible.
But, you know, you feel bad and you feel like you're two-timing. But Gray Wolf had just been on my radar. They're the best poetry press in the country, in my opinion. And when they finally made the decision, I decided to go with them, and I'm really, really glad I did. They're so professional in terms of marketing, how they handle you, how they do publicity.
Sending you on a book tour, aren't
they? I'm going on a book tour, which is really cool. I'll be reading with two other Gray Wolf poets, Mary Jo Bang, who teaches at Washington University in St. Louis, and Nick Flynn, who people may know more from his creative nonfiction. He did a memoir called Another Bullshit Night in Suck City, and it's about meeting his father years and years after the father left the family in a homeless shelter that Nick was working in. So that should be really interesting to read with these amazing presences and poets. Yeah, I feel very lucky.
Are your poems autobiographical, or is it a mix of imagination and autobiography?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's something I talk a lot about as a teacher. It's definitely, I think I'm by nature a surrealist, and so my poems are fed by my experiences, but they're often mythologized or brought into kind of fluid relationship with reality, I guess. So Four-Legged Girl, for instance, That emerged. I'd seen the photo that you see on the cover. Mm-hmm. She was a real girl with four real legs.
So that's an actual photograph. We're looking at this cover of a girl with four legs.
Her name was Myrtle Corbin. I think she was born in Texas, and of course, she was put into circuses. She had children. And I had just always been fascinated with her and with this photo, and kind of realized I've had this long fascination with too many limbs or two heads or something about the freak. And I set her in the title poem out in this area near Vandalia, Michigan, called Ramp Town. And it was a site of where escaped slaves were allowed to live on farmland that was owned by a Quaker. Vandalia was a very Quaker town. And I'd been fascinated with Ramp Town and this idea of ramps are the wild onions. Right. So they think that's why it was called that, the sort of scattered wild. So there's Ramp Town and my sort of vicinity, which is always important to me, this part of Michigan. And then kind of the holy freak of four-legged girl. And somehow I think in the process of writing the poem, she became kind of an image for what poetry is to me. And then something about those escapees and what it took for them to find a measure of freedom melded together in this poem somehow. So it's a it's a strange, and the kind of vibration of the poem is, if I can't have that, if I can't have you, then it's the boneyard for me. Mm. Through the process of the book, it's a lot about love, desire, kind of desirelessness, gender, and what's after desire. And I come to these poems that are sort of about an ascendant female power. And she's kind of where I end up. She's the last poem.
And that female power is something that comes up in all your collections. So what is femininity to you?
Well, it's not pink, but my cover is. Let's see. Well, the first thing that comes to my mind when you ask me that is my mom, because she's such a interesting, iconoclastic, powerful woman who will be 86 on Saturday and is still doing all her own house. And yeah, she's amazing. And she reinvented herself after my father died when she was 32, went to college, got a degree in English, brought Virginia Woolf and James Joyce into the house in Niles, Michigan. And she just always has struck me as kind of an icon of female power, but not sort of femmy at all.
Yeah.
You know, never did the makeup, never did the hairdo.
Yeah.
I wears pants and jeans and t-shirts and is very comfortable in her body and in her life.
Yeah.
She doesn't ask for a lot. And she just found she knows how to just be. So femininity to me, femaleness is that, is sort of
comfort in who you are?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think I'm particularly, I find, I admire women who kind of fight the pressure to be coupled and who find great strength and joy in their solo act. I had that with my mom, and now I have it in my own life. Mm. And to have found that sort of it was unlikely because I always found myself sort of partnering up. It took a long time to get out of that habit.
Yeah, yeah.
But now that I'm out of it, I just feel this incredible degree of freedom.
I hear you.
I thought you would.
So one of the things that I noticed in the poems, and that's why I asked about the autobiographical element, Di, did you ever write romance novels?
I did.
You did. I want to read one of those.
Yeah, actually, I wrote a couple romances and then another genre that I won't go into right now when I lived in New York. You know,
that's in there too.
That other genre. Yes. I have a poem that's sort of almost a picaresque, like, here's the adventure of my time in New York.
Yeah.
That one's pretty true. Yeah. And so I was secretarying, and for extra money, I somehow got hooked up with a publishing house that published romances. And it's amazing how circumscribed it is. Like, they tell you the plot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they tell you sort of in a paragraph, these are the plot basics. Here's what the man does. Here's what the woman does. Here's what he looks like. Here's what she looks like.
You don't even get to create that part.
No, no. And you're writing by formula.
Yeah. So are these still available somewhere?
You know, I've looked on eBay and everything. I can't find them. I wish I had one
copy. Did you write under
copy.
Your own name?
No. I wrote the first one with somebody. I think we did every other chapter. And he was a film director who, he ended up dying of AIDS. He became pretty well known. He did a documentary on William Burroughs and also a Madonna movie before he passed away. But his name was Howard, but I think his real name was Eric Howard. So we went with Erica, and then my mom's maiden name was Claire. So Erica Claire. So I kept that even when I did my own. But what I found was they were so boring to write that I would just, it was
worse. You write one, you write them all?
Yeah. And it's always, the formula was the man is always older, dark haired, has a brooding personality.
Tall.
Yes, and a secret, kind of flat version of Mr. Rochester and Jane Eyre. And the woman, younger, more naive, maybe a nurse at best, who, you know, thinks she can save him, and they sort of have a burgeoning feelings for each other, and then there's some kind of breakdown when she discovers the secret, but then they come back together. And there's a kiss on the last page.
Oh, okay. Takes that long. What
yes.
a tease.
So I didn't get to do the sexier romances, like that you see with the bodice ripping
yes.
ones. Yeah. I didn't get to do that. These were more straight up, pure. Mm-hmm. But after a couple, I couldn't do it anymore.
I understand that you binge write. You're not a steady diet of a poem a day,
no.
But, you know, talk about that, your writing style.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a woman thing, too. I'm not a person who, you know, goes to a desk every day for 3 hours. And then I've always sort of had to write as I live, between the broccoli chopping and grading papers and diapering. Maybe a poem happened at 2 a.m. And what I wanted to say was that really changed. I was in residency last summer at an amazing residence for women writers on an island in Puget Sound. And I got to find my own rhythm without all the other responsibilities. And I wrote every day, and it was lovely. So maybe,
given your way.
Yes, I could do that. But that's just not how my life went. Yeah, so my next book, after Four-Legged Girl, is a real shift. That is, it was more of a project book. So
there's one in the works.
It's pretty much done. I'm working on revising it right now.
Poetry?
Yes. It's called, right now, Still Life with Two Dead Peacocks and a Girl, which was a Rembrandt painting. And it's all about, I mean, in one way or another, it's all about painting. So the poem that was in the New Yorker recently is from that. Specifically about still life painting, but it kind of goes outside of that a little too.
Outside of the lines.
Yeah.
You said before that your poetry is an antidote to death or a bridge between the living and the dead.
Yes.
I found that in another interview and thought that was interesting.
Well, I think I needed that bridge. It's what got me started writing so young. Because my dad died when I was so little, I couldn't have a sustained relationship with him, obviously. So poetry kind of became a way, it was a language different from everyday language, that I could find him again, or at least work to make sense of the mystery of his passing.
So poetry is something of a spiritual experience for you?
I think so, yeah. Spiritual and earthy, and sort of, I find in it a higher kind of knowing. In other words, I think my poems know more than I do. So I learn a lot from the poem. And some of it is just in working it out. Like, you know, if you have a form or if you're working from a painting or some sort of limiting device like that, in having to work that out, you come upon things. It's like, oh, for instance, in the poem that was in the New Yorker, Still Life with Turkey, is from another painting, that what I learned from that was how important seeing had become to me, really looking, and partly because I never saw my dad after he died. My mom didn't make me go look at him. And so it's like I got this hunger for looking. And I really hadn't thought about that until the poem led me there. Or in the title poem of Four-Legged Girl, you know, you have these very different things. A girl with four legs from the 1800s in Texas who was in freak shows, and Ramptown in Vandalia, Michigan, which is no longer, it's a disappeared space, and then poetry. And what do those three things have in common? I don't know until the poem tells me. So that's what I love. I love learning from that sort of higher understanding that poetry gives me.
Yeah, every poem is discovery.
It is.
Can we close with another poem? I'd love to hear you read another.
Sure. This is a short one. And actually, this was in the Best American Poetry last year. It's called Free Beer. So it came as a result of the fact that when I was a kid, I went around the neighborhood. I was really young, like maybe 4 or 5, and I invited everybody to this puppet show I was going to have. And the way I would get them there was to say that there was going to be free beer. Well, you'll hear what happened, but it's not really a narrative poem. In a sense, it's another one of those things where there's a mysterious intersection. So there's that story, and then the sense when, for instance, when I look at somebody on the news who's done something terrible, like the shooters, and I think who can pray with them? Who can sit with them? And so those two things, I don't know why they came together, but they did. And here's the poem, Free Beer. I'm the one who can hold a mouthful of salt. Bring him here, the fool dressed in prison stripes. I can pray for him, even though his eyes are wild. I can delouse the rat. When I was a kid, I invited them all to a puppet show. There were no puppets. I'd planned no show. Free beer, I said, and they came. I've seen a puppet theater. It resides in the black cavern behind my eyes. Thoughts are puppets dangling from their tangled strings. Bring him here, the one spinning on gloom's rotisserie. I'll section an orange for the wretched bastard. I'll ladle him up a mug full of tears. Free beer, I'll say, though there is no beer.